Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Good evening, fight fans. This is the Rattlegion Broadcasting Network History of Heavyweight Boxing Podcast. I'm your host, the Mandated Reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattledge. And tonight, we turn the page to Chapter 14. It is a tale of two boxers occupying the same body. Ladies and gentlemen. Woo-wee! What we're talking about is George Foreman. Yes, sir. Helping me do that tonight, and maybe helping me out with my pronunciations, because apparently I've been drinking. Speaking of drinking, ladies and gentlemen, it's Pat Mullen. How do you do, sir?
I'm quite offended that you would say, speaking of drinking.
And what is tonight's podcast brought to the people by?
Tonight is sponsored by Coors Banquet, because when watching Cobra Kai, one must indulge fully.
I feel like I've asked you this before, and I feel like we've talked about this, but were you into the Coors Banquet before Johnny made it popular on Cobra Kai, or after?
Oh, absolutely not. I refuse to drink any Coors because I just drank Coors Light pretty much at that point, and that's water, so I had pretty much written off all Coors. Banquet's not so bad.
Very good. In March, we are going to be doing a Metal Hammer of Doom on St. Patrick's Day. I intend to be half in the bag on a pack of Guinness, which reminds me, hey, make sure you buy Guinness for St. Patrick's Day.
Okay.
Gotta make sure the wife knows what's going on. You know what I mean, Pat? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's why you gotta have steaks in the freezer, too, in case she speaks out of turn.
That's right. Afternoon, everybody. Hope you're enjoying the podcast. All right. So, it's a tale of two boxers tonight, Pat. We have the George Foreman that fought in the era of heavyweight kings, the 60s and 70s. And then he disappears for a while and comes back in the second golden age of heavyweight boxing, the late 80s, early 90s, the era of Tyson and Holyfield and whatnot. So this will be a fun podcast to do, talking about George the First and then the comeback George. Any thoughts before we get into this on George in general? Where does he stand in the Pat Mullen Hall of Fame of boxing?
George was the first real heavyweight I remember just being enamored with and wanting to watch every time he was on. And this is, of course, during his second career in the late 80s and the early to mid-90s, where he was a very different George than the one who had terrorized boxing in the 1970s. But he was, a grandfatherly figure that we'll talk about a little bit how that developed. But he was one of those guys who, when I was real young and not even a huge boxing fan, he was one of the guys that I would hear and I had to watch him fight. Him, Terry Norris, Johnny Tapia, that whole group of guys at the time that I knew of and heard of, but they were must-see. And George was a must-see to the point where when I had to write a project on an Olympic gold medalist in the fifth grade, I chose George Foreman.
Did you watch his sitcom?
The brief period of time that it aired, yes. Also, my dad and uncle accused Tony Danza of stealing the idea for said sitcom from Dennis Hamill, who had written for the New York Daily News, which I find absurd and about as credible as Dr. Evil's father claiming he invented the question mark.
All right. My own sort of history with George Foreman. Of course, I knew nothing of the first part of his career. You know, you hear of the before we started doing this podcast and the little knowledge I had of the golden age of boxing. You know, it was Ali, Ali, Ali. So you knew of the Rumble in the Jungle, you know, but Ali was always the focus. George was the guy he beat. George was the guy he rope-a-doped. And I never gave much thought to him. I remember as a kid, so, you know, 1987, 88, I'm 11, 12 years old. And I remember, like, the press on George at the time was something along the lines of, you know, this middle-aged man is making this crazy comeback in boxing, and oh, isn't this a circus? And as a kid who didn't know any better, I really bought into that. I was like, yeah, I don't understand why he's doing this. And I think that's going to be the mission statement of tonight's show, is to show people, one, what a wrecking machine George Foreman was. Use the word terrorized, and that is an apt description of what he did to his opponents up until his mini-retirement after being beaten by Ali. And then what he brought to boxing in his comeback and his quest for and succeeding in accomplishing winning heavyweight gold. So let us begin our story by saying that Mr. George Foreman was born in Marshall, Texas. He grew up in the Fifth Ward community of Houston with six siblings. He was raised by J.D. Foreman, whom his mother had married when George was a small child. His biological father was Leroy Moorhead. By his own admission in his autobiography, George was a troubled youth. He dropped out of school at the age of 15 and spent time as a mugger. At the age of 16, Foreman had a change of heart and convinced his mother to sign him up for the Job Corps after seeing an ad for the Corps on TV. As part of the Job Corps, Foreman earned his GED and trained to become a carpenter and a bricklayer. After moving to Pleasanton, California, with the help of a supervisor, he began to train as a boxer. Foreman only had 18 amateur fights when he qualified for the 68 U.S. Olympic team. He won the gold, succeeding eventual opponent Joe Frazier as the heavyweight gold medalist by battering USSR fighter Jonas Chapulis. During the same Olympic runners, Tommy Smith and John Carlos launched Black Power salutes at their medal ceremony. In contrast, Foreman took an American flag and marched around the ring waving it. As a professional, Foreman was trained by Dick Sadler and former light heavyweight champion and heavyweight title challenger Archie Moore. Pat, 50 words or less on Dick Sadler.
Dick was an old-time trainer, affiliated himself with Archie and broke in a lot of guys. And if they were worth anything, Archie would also step in and then start showing them the real tricks of the trade. So, but Dick was a good guy to recognize base talent and try to develop guys and show them fundamental skills before they moved on to the advanced stuff.
So he absolutely tore through the division, amassing a record of 37-0 with 34 KOs. Yeah, he really demolished people. Among his victims were top 10 ranked George Chavallo, whom we've talked about before. He stopped him in three rounds, and then he took on Argentine Gregorio Peralta. Peralta became the first opponent who went to a decision with Foreman and showed a vulnerability in George to quick counterpunching. Foreman had been a sparring partner for former heavyweight champion Sonny Liston, who we've also talked about on this podcast. Sonny was a de facto mentor to George. George emulated Sonny Liston in his dealings with the press and developed one of the most devastating jabs in history, just as his mentor did. All right, this brings us to January 22nd, 1973, where after 37 fights as a professional, he got his chance at the current WBA, WBC, and ring heavyweight champion, Joe Frazier. This took place in the National Stadium in Kingston, Jamaica, where George pummeled the crap out of Joe Frazier. Pat, you know, it's funny. I just watched this in preparation for this show, and I was thinking about, like, years later, and we'll talk about this when we get there, but years later, George Foreman will try to angle a fight with Mike Tyson, who for a heavyweight was shorter than most of his opponents, just as Joe Frazier was much shorter than the very large and very powerful George Foreman. And I'm wondering if people showed Mike Tyson what happened to poor Joe Frazier in this fight and was like, just stay the hell away from George. Oh my God, Pat, what happened in the two rounds that Joe Frazier got his brains beat in?
It's arguably the most condensed beatdown in a high-profile fight between two all-time greats that you'll ever see.
It was very Jack Dempsey-like. Even with the neutral corner rule, this was like the spirit of Jack Dempsey had jumped into George Foreman.
Yeah, it was kind of almost the visual opposite of Jack Dempsey and Jeff Swillard, where the little guy is getting the crap kicked out of him for once. And you know, from a style standpoint, George has always in his first career been considered a very crude slugger. But to write him off like that isn't fair, because this fight, maybe more than any other he had in his first career, showed off a lot of the little tricks of the trade that he learned that he could execute well. And a lot of what he does that makes Joe so ineffective in this fight is you often see George, especially in his younger career, with the extended arms, which is where we'll get to with Ali calling him the mummy, because his arms are always out straight. But George had big arms, and they served many purposes. He was able to intercept punches because of the size of his arms, which he'll do in his later career as well. But also what he could do with those extended arms is put them on an opponent's shoulders where he could reach them and they couldn't reach him, and he could push them, pull them, and shift them off balance so that they can't set the punch. And that's exactly what he did to Joe over the course of this fight that allowed him to dominate him the way he did. Joe Frazier was never able to get set and throw that big left hook or get inside or bob under or pin his head to George's chest and start working on the inside, because George was smart enough and deft enough to know that I need to keep him on the outside so he can't hit me, but I also need to make sure he stays on the outside, and even then he can't launch anything. So he constantly pushes, pulls, maneuvers, manipulates, and uses that reach advantage in a way that a lot of guys don't know how to do, almost from a wrestling standpoint of controlling your opponent's balance and leverage. And it's really brilliant. And you mentioned Mike Tyson. So we talked a little bit about how Customato had kind of told Mike at a young age that you're going to fight Larry Holmes and you're going to beat him. And here's how you're going to beat him. You're going to, every time he throws that double jab, you're going to throw a right hand over the top of it. And eventually it's going to land, it's going to hurt him, and you're going to follow up. And when Mike and Larry actually did fight years later, albeit Larry was past his best, that's what happened. Mike was able to launch his right hand over Larry's jab and hit him and knock him out. With George, it was the opposite, where Cuss basically always told Mike that he never wanted him to fight a guy like this because the style matchup is all wrong. And he specifically pointed to George as the guy, like, if this guy was ever to fight you, you wouldn't do so well. You're not going to do well. You're gonna get hurt by this guy, and he's gonna hit you, and he's going to hurt you, and he's going to control you. You don't fight this guy. And I can't help but always think that was in the back of Mike Tyson's mind for a lot of reasons, because you get told certain truths by somebody who you put all of your trust into, and there's no reason to doubt them. And when it comes time to face those things, a lot of times it'll lift you up and help you execute, like it did against Larry Holmes. Against George, even an older George, but a George who still employed these types of tricks, would have been interesting to see.
No doubt. Well, you know, as you were saying, Frazier got knocked down 6 times in 2 rounds before the thing was finally over. And I think Frazier left a bit of himself in the ring that night. I don't think he was ever quite the same. That's a rough fight. George Foreman would move on to defend his title against Jose Roman in Nippon, Tokyo, Japan, and he would retain his WBA, WBC, and ring heavyweight titles on September 1st, 1973. The next up, was his fight with Ken Norton. Norton was coming off of his first two bouts against Ali, where he broke Ali's jaw and won a decision before losing a controversial decision to Ali in an immediate rematch. Much like Frazier, however, Norton posed a little problem for the defending champion. Foreman would find his power range early and bomb Norton continuously until stopping him before the end of the second round. Foreman took almost a mythic aura at this point, with many people believing him to be unbeatable. Let's talk about that for a minute, Pat. It's 1974, March 26th. He takes on Ken Norton in Caracas, Venezuela, and he's 40-0 up to this point, with most of his wins by pretty vicious KOs or TKOs. What's the, you know, you talk about this mythic aura of George Foreman up to this point. What was the press saying about him? What was the belief? What were people sort of murmuring about George Foreman at this point? Because, we didn't have Ali there for a bit. He just knocked out, in brutal fashion, Joe Frazier. He's the king of the heavyweights at this point. What's the word on George Foreman going into the Rumble in the Jungle?
You know, the Rumble in the Jungle is, or the Rumble in the Jungle, excuse me, is pretty much looked at as being an unfortunate thing that's going to happen, because it's going to be Ali's last stand, and this great champion is going to get hurt by this unstoppable wrecking machine. And it's not without merit at the time. You look at Ali and the two guys who had not only given him his toughest fights, but beaten him at this point in time. George Foreman knocked both of them out in two rounds, and did so without any kind of real opposition to him. You know, in addition to those guys, he stopped Shivalo. He beat Peralta twice at this point. He's fought Chuck Wepner and beaten him to God knows how poorly. He actually had his cheekbone sticking out. He's beaten everybody he's faced and done so in pretty remarkable fashion. Ali's seen as not being what he was in the 60s because of the loss, really more to Norton than the Frazier loss. And he's coming off of the rematch with Norton that a lot of people think he was, you know, lucky to get the decision in certain respects. So you see George, who's done wrecked Ali's toughest opposition with minimal effort, hasn't had anybody really pose a threat to him. He's 40-0, 37 knockouts. This is going to be thought to be a public execution.
So we've talked at length about the Rumble in the Jungle. The ropes are loose. Ali, after about a round or two, starts leaning against the ropes. He's able to evade a lot or take the stuffing out of a lot of George Foreman's punches. George Foreman's greatest asset, you know, you talked about the way that he held his arms, you know, his defensive style of boxing. Would Ali would not only use that against him, but also use it as a way to ridicule him, you know, call him the mummy and all of that. This was one of those fights where psychologically, like, Ali got into Foreman's head. I believe this is also the fight where Foreman couldn't spar leading into the fight because he got cut.
Yeah, and the fight had been postponed, so George ended up spending extra time in Africa, away from everything that he needed.
Right. So there's a lot of things that went into Ali's favor and really against George. In an alternate universe, and I've been waiting to ask you this, I wanted to get your opinion. In an alternate universe where they do this fight, instead of in Africa, they do it at Madison Square Garden, and he doesn't get cut in training. What do you think happens?
I think in the first meeting between these two, no matter what, I think Ali still employs the rope-a-dope successfully. Maybe the round varies, but I think Ali still gets him based on just much, much superior tactical planning and understanding of what was going to happen and what advantages he could take. And again, in addition to waging psychological warfare on George, where I think it's the seventh round of the fight, and George is really just punching with everything he's got left. And he does land a shot on Ali, and Ali's response at that point is to say to him, "Is that all you got, George?" And George always tells the story that in his head he was like, "Yep, that's all I got."
Yeah, one thing that I think, he's such a powerful guy, but watching some of his older fights, and definitely as he got to be middle-aged, this would certainly become a degree of difficulty for him. I don't know how much he had in the gas department. I don't know how much he had in the endurance.
Well, you know, the big thing in his younger career, and it's so different in his older career, we'll talk about, but you can see it here, the amount of the adrenal dump that's in him as soon as the fight starts and the way he's throwing his punches. You know, again, we talked about how people kind of wrote him off as a crude slugger without any kind of science or strategy behind what he was doing. There was strategy to what he was doing. But in his punching technique, was he a crude slugger? Absolutely. He's throwing roundhouses in many respects. He's throwing punches from left field. And he's got maybe the best jab we'll ever see in this ramrod telephone pole jab that his jab is as hard as most guys, you know, crosses. And it really is a power punch the way he throws it. But again, you see these punches he throws. And I sent Mark a video from the documentary When We Were Kings of George hitting the heavy bag. And for comparison's sake, I sent Mark a video of me hitting the heavy bag in the same manner. Now, I'm not a small guy. I'm 6'1". I generally end up weighing anywhere from 240 to 260 pounds, depending on the day and what I'm eating or drinking for that matter. And I'm making solid contact on this bag. I'm hitting it, and you can hear it. And then you see the video of George, who's actually indenting the heavy bag with someone holding on to the other end of it. That's an insane amount of power, but in the same respect the way George throws his punches, and we kind of talked about this with Rocky Marciano a little bit, there's two kinds of power punchers. There's your snapping punchers who get that snap off at the end of a punch, and the reason it hurts a guy is because they don't see it. And then there's a clubber, which is what George falls into the category of, where George is coming from a far out angle where you see his punch coming. And you can brace yourself for it. But it still hurts and demoralizes you so bad that eventually it breaks you down. And the fact that he's that kind of puncher but still scores knockouts, like especially against like Norton, where he does knock the guy out cold with the punches he's throwing, is an insane level of power. That's just not normal. Like, George had an exceptional level of power that few guys in the fight game ever seemingly reached to.
So, as we've talked about, Muhammad Ali was able to win the title back in an 8-round KO from an exhausted George Foreman, who, you know, as he's talked about with that fight, and we mentioned in the past, was just like, I hit him with everything I had, and I'm all out of punches to throw, and Ali, would pay for it years later, but in that time, you know, at the height of his powers, so to speak, he was able to take advantage of an exhausted George Foreman, and he was able to absorb an enormous amount of punishment. So, George Foreman, he has this look. He's huge, first of all. He's a big dude. He has a big old 70s afro, and he has this sneer of a street criminal. He looks ridiculously intimidating. And that messed with his image. Not to mention he comes off as the villain against Ali. And so there is this picture of George.
Well, and he also embraced that image, to be fair.
And that's what I was getting to. You know, Sonny Liston, as we talked about earlier, definitely had the image of a very intimidating sort of negative person. And I, for whatever the reasons were, George thought that this is the way I should present myself.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? they're also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Self. And after the Ali thing, I guess he took a look in the mirror and was like, maybe I don't need to be the villain anymore. Maybe I need to fix my image a bit. And this is how he tried. And and we need to talk about this for a minute because Oi is right. You know, this works when you're Andre the Giant. I'm not sure this works if you're a real-life boxer. Holy cow. So Foreman takes 75 off after trying a disastrous exhibition in Toronto where he fought, quote-unquote, five opponents. The idea behind it was to give George... to have George against the odds and seen as an underdog for people to get behind. However, Pat... He's in the ring having exhibitions with this, you know, gauntlet of opponents who he's demolishing, and people like, stop, you're killing them, you bully, you animal. This blew up in George's face. Talk to me, Pat. What all went wrong here?
So I'll tell you first, one of the guys he fought in this exhibition was Jerry Judge. Years later, my best friend, Brendan, if you're listening, what's up? My best friend's cousin wound up dating a guy with the last name of Judge who happened to be the son of this fellow. And he was around for a little while, so one day I asked him, I was like, you ever ask your dad about what it was like being in the ring with George? And he said, yeah, you know, I talked to him about it, you know, a bunch. And, you know, I was like, so what do you have to say? He goes, if you've ever been hit by a car, imagine that happening over and over and over again. And pretty much all I needed to know, and I think we can all safely assume that, but it's different to hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. And, I don't know who convinced George that this would be the way to get public sentiment on his side, but when you've been portrayed as this, you know, Sonny Liston type of bully, and you all of a sudden, I'm going to fight five guys... I think I made the comparison to you offline that he was like Goliath on the mountaintop calling down to the Israelite to send me your next champion, and surely I will kill him.
Yeah. Oof.
I don't know who George hired to work as PR or anything like that, but you've got this guy just bludgeoning these overmatched guys, you know. And on top of all that, you have Ali at ringside with Howard Cosell during the proceedings, who is not only taunting George, but is also cheerleading the crowd to rally behind the fighters and yelling instructions to the fighters at ringside how to beat George.
Again, this works if you're Andre the Giant. Andre the Giant is a circus attraction. He, you know, he's 8 feet tall or some, you know, whatever he was. And, you know, people are there to see him wrestle three guys. They're there to see the attraction Andre the Giant. This doesn't... And so I can see the pitch. It's like, well, you know, this is happening out in the world. Why don't we do something similar to that? You can't fight them all at once, obviously, but what if you run this gauntlet and you can show people how tough you are? And like, I can see the math working... But, yeah, it didn't work out that way. Not at all.
Yeah, it was completely counterproductive to public sentiment in regards to George, where, again, he was just looked at as a bully who was trying to show off. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like you'd see him standing outside the school at the lunch line waiting for kids to show up and just demanding that everybody has to go through him to get lunch, and he's going to take out everybody. And... you know, in a very 3 o'clock high type of moment. And it was a public relations disaster. It was looked at as farcical by everybody who saw it. George, even in fighting these guys, didn't look particularly impressive because none of these guys were top 10 rated. So it was one of those things where you went from being, you know, the champion and you just lost to Ali, and that's fine, but now you're doing a silly circus exhibition. It really did a number on him, and is one of the reasons that he wasn't able to secure a rematch with Ali.
The way you win the hearts and minds of the public is to be a hero. is, you know, to get in there, blood and guts, fight your heart out with equal or better opposition and come out the victor. And lucky for him, that's what happened next. January 24th, 1976, at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, Nevada, he wins the vacant NABF heavyweight title against Ron Lyle, whom he knocks out in five rounds. And this is five rounds of rock'em sock'em, holy cow, punch for punch. You know, in indie wrestling, in some of the indie garbage wrestling, two guys will take chairs and they'll put them in the center of the ring. And like John Moxley's done a little bit of this, and they'll just take turns punching each other in the face. And that's what Ron Lyle and Georgia Foreman did without the chairs or the pretense of fakery. These two guys stood in the center of the ring at Caesar's Palace and punched each other dead in the mush until one of them finally gave up. Holy cow, Pat.
Yeah, there's no pretense of boxing in this fight. This is a street fight with gloves. You have two of the three biggest power hitters of the era at this time in George and Ron Lyle, with all respect to Ernie Shavers, who's the other guy in that mix. But you have two guys who, both of them are behemoths for the time period. They are huge men. And all they do is, you know, both of them fight the same style. They're big power hitters. They're not looking to finesse you for 12, 15 rounds. They want to take you out. And when you have two guys like that and they match up, usually as soon as one guy lands their big shot on the other, the immediate response doesn't become, oh, wow, he hits pretty hard. I might want to take a different approach. I might want to buy. No, I'm going to show him that I hit him just as hard and I take it better. And what results is Roadhouse. And Roadhouse. So much so that I forget what fight it was that we had watched and we were kind of disappointed in. And then I was like, you know, if you really want to see something, Mark, I'll show you a heavyweight fight. And you and I and Rob did an alternate commentary over this. And you were just enamored with it. And still to this day, it was the fight of the year for 1976, including Rocky versus Apollo. It was it had the round of the year in it. And it's gone down as one of the immortal must-see heavyweight slugfests of all time.
It is a sight to behold. If you're listening to this podcast and you're not as familiar with this era of boxing, it's on YouTube. Go watch it. It is
It's one of the
phenomenal.
Five most action-packed heavyweight fights there's ever been.
Yeah, for sure. So next up, June 15th, 1976, at my old stomping grounds of the Nassau Coliseum, home of the Islanders, or at least it was, he retains the NABF heavyweight title in a rematch against Joe Frazier, whom he gets a TKO victory over in the fifth round. Any thoughts on Foreman Frazier 2?
This was kind of a delay of the inevitable. This was the last Joe really had. This is after Manila, and so he really had whatever was left. I mean, he was almost completely blind as a whole in that fight because his good eyes swelled shut. He's fighting in this fight with a contact lens, trying to restore sight in his bad eye. Just was never really in the fight. He dances a little bit more and boxes from the outside. But again, the style matchup in this plus his impairment, it's inevitable what's going to happen. George catches him finally in the fifth, drops him twice, and that's the end of Smoking Joe for the most part until a one-off comeback fight years later. But this was a kind of seen as almost an unnecessary rematch. But there was, again, you're talking about a guy in George who won the title, defended it, didn't get a rematch. This was seen as potentially a reason to get a rematch with Ali, is if he could get past Joe and do it in a certain way, and he did. But the rematch isn't to come.
No. The next three guys don't even make it to the fifth round. We have three TK victories in a row throughout the rest of 76 and the early part of 77 against Scott Ledoux, John Dino Dennis, and Pedro Augusto. He wipes them out in four rounds or less. Which then takes us to a rather strange one. March 17th, 1977, in San Juan, Puerto Rico. He goes the distance with Jimmy Young. We've talked about Jimmy Young before. Pat, Jimmy Young upsets George Foreman, winning a unanimous decision victory. What happened here?
Well, I'll be very honest. I've watched this fight multiple times, and I still think George won the fight. However, what happened here was you have George, who trained for the fight but didn't train in Puerto Rico, and flew in the day before the fight to go weigh in and fight in the Puerto Rican heat, which, if you've never been down there, can be very brutal, against Jimmy Young, who is a quick, defensive-minded counterpuncher, which has exposed holes in George's game before. And George, having seemingly not learned enough from his fight with Ali, again starts to wear down in the Puerto Rican heat as the fight goes on. And by the 11th and 12th round really doesn't seem to have a lot left, even though he's hurt Jimmy Young in this fight, scored a knockdown that wasn't called a knockdown, but he really seems to be running out of gas in the 11th, and Young's picking up steam. And in the 12th round, Jimmy Young, who is a light hitter for a heavyweight, think of him as a 70s version of Chris Bird almost. Jimmy Young knocks George Foreman down in a moment that shocked everybody, including George, the way he reacts to it. And he goes down and he gets back up very nervously, very quickly, almost as if the knockdown jolted his whole body, even though he was exhausted in shock, and pulls himself up. And he goes on to lose the decision. But it's really what happens to him after the fact that's interesting.
You know, after Ali and what he went through, you know, the disaster in Toronto.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And then this loss to Jimmy Young, I really think psychologically George Foreman was very affected. And that's not to take away from how he describes it. He describes it as an epiphany. He has a religious experience. And he decides to take time away from the sport.
He basically has a vision that after the fight, when he's in his locker room, and you know, again, you have a guy who is, yes, probably suffering through, you know, severe dehydration, exhaustion, you know, psychologically, again, the damage is there. But that's not to discredit his view of it. Like we said, George literally sees himself in hell and begs God to save his life. And when he comes back to his senses, he turns his life over to becoming a man of the cloth and becomes an ordained minister and preacher for Baptist Christian churches in Houston, Texas.
I want to talk about this because he takes the next 10 years off. He dedicates himself to Christ. He opens up a youth center. This youth center is pivotal in his comeback, which we'll talk about in a moment. But I want to talk about the 10 years that he's gone. So from 77 to 87, he's not a part of professional boxing. He is ministering to his flock. He is dedicating himself to Christ. And we've talked about the intervening years between the late 70s and, you know, in the mid 80s. It's the era from the end of Ali to the beginning of Tyson. We did an entire chapter on this, Pat. It was called Forgotten Sons. And I ask you, Pat, I ask you, in a parallel universe where he beats Jimmy Young and probably ends up getting that rematch with Ali before Ali calls it quits, had Foreman not taken a decade off, had Foreman been there in the vacuum of Ali, do we have Forgotten Sons, or do we have Foreman reigning supreme? What do you think?
You know, it's really interesting to me to think about how a George in 78, 79 would have fared against the Larry Holmes.
Right.
that's to me the big fight, because on one hand you have in Larry a guy who was quick-handed, excellent jab, good outside skills, could do the things to George that beat George. At the same time, you have a Larry who was hit by guys like Ernie Shavers and dropped and hurt. And as hard as Ernie Shavers hit, everybody will always tell you that Ernie Shavers was in fact the hardest puncher that the heavyweight division has ever seen. On one shot, I'm inclined to agree. But Ernie also, in that same token, if he didn't finish you with the shot he clipped you with, he wasn't a great follow-up guy and didn't have those same level of explosion or skills that George had. So it's interesting to think how that would have happened. I'm inclined to think they probably fight more than once over that period of time. But, it'd be interesting to see, because, again, you're talking about if George beats Jimmy Young, he probably gets a title shot. Well, Ali's probably still the champion at this time. And I don't think Ali fights him. I think Ali retires rather than give George a rematch, because I'm not going to say Ali ducked George, because that's silly. But I think he was very careful about not fighting George under perfect circumstances for himself again.
Certainly, we talked about the different sanctioning bodies wanting to create a star in the absence of Ali. That was the premise of the whole Forgotten Sons episode. They'd have had one there in George Foreman. And, now who's to say he's anywhere near the success that he had at the early part of his career. Maybe he does. Maybe he decimates some of these guys. And I think that's kind of my follow-up question. When you think about the guys, the Dokes and the whatnots, the Sphinxes, who were around in that time and were trading around the belts or whatever, how many of these guys do you think Foreman beats, and how many of them beat him?
It's so difficult to really break it down, because these guys, the biggest thing with all these guys that we talked about in Forgotten Sons is either unrealized potential or just, a lack of work ethic. Something always held them back. And the thing that held George back in his youth was not a lack of a work ethic or a lack of potential. It was just the style he fought in could be exploited by a good opponent. And there are guys who had great fundamental skills. Tony Tubbs had great fundamental skills. Tim Witherspoon, when he used them, had great fundamental skills. I don't think any of them were better fighters than George, and I don't think any of them were consistent enough in any way for me to favor them over George during this period of time. Again, with the exception of possibly Larry Holmes, depending on when they met.
Right. So George, as we said, takes 10 years off to tend to his religious wants and needs, and he opens up a youth center, and he has money in this youth center, which is then summarily stolen by somebody he trusted. So needing money, and having been 10 years away from the game, and kind of reinventing himself as this new person, he decides to go back to boxing. He's going to make a comeback, and part of it was driven by the idea of age is nothing but a number. I'm going to show people that just because you're over 30 doesn't mean you're dead. Your life is over.
Vote is not a death sentence.
Yeah, that he can come back in what many would consider to be, in most boxers' cases, the downstage of their careers. This is when he's going to make a comeback, and he's looking at Tyson. This is 1987, and Tyson's the youngest world champion, and world heavyweight champion, and he's looking for a fight with Mike. But he's got to earn his way back to the top. And here starts the 20-fight march of doom. Holy Christ, Pat. He goes from Steve Zuski on March 9th, 1987, in Sacramento, California, and proceeds to lay people out on an average of 5 rounds, give or take. Poor Bobby Hitz didn't even make it out of the first round. and so he marched, decimating guys left and right. The Tour of Death finally ends with Everett Martin on July 20th, 1989, in Tucson, Arizona, which went to a decision, mercifully.
Bigfoot Martin, not a chump.
And that takes us to his first high-profile fight in Atlantic City, New Jersey, on January 15th, 1990, against Jerry Cooney. So remind us, Jerry, who Jerry Cooney was.
Jerry Cooney was one of the big heavyweight what-if prospects of the 80s, who we talked about fighting Larry Holmes in the highest-grossing fight of the heavyweight championship of the world at that point. Jerry was the last guy who was really at the time considered the great white hope by a racially divided American boxing public. And again, a guy with a great left hook, great size, and looked to have the tools that could potentially make a heavyweight champion, but didn't necessarily have the best people around him. And a lot of people thought he was rushed into his fight with Larry to cash in on that. And Jerry, as a result of that, kind of developed into a depression and never realized his potential as a heavyweight. And since the fight with Larry Holmes, he had two comeback fights in 1984 and 1985 that he won. Other than that, his last time that he was active was in 1987. He fought Michael Spinks for the lineal heavyweight championship of the world. And after a good start, Spinks just bludgeoned him with overhand rights and stopped him. And Jerry, you know, much like George, is a guy who he sees George coming back and making a run of it, and maybe I can do this too. And into this fight, Jerry's actually trained by a guy who used to train George. George's trainer, after the Rumble in the Jungle, became Gil Clancy, based out of New York, legendary Hall of Fame trainer. But George isn't training with him anymore at this point. George is actually trained by two guys, Charlie Shipes, who oversees the day-to-day training, and his strategist, Angelo Dundee, who, of course, was in the opposite corner from him in Kinshasa, Zaire, when Muhammad Ali shocked the world. But Cooney, for this fight, is actually being trained by Gil Clancy, who worked with George, you know, in 1976 and 1975 and 77, up until George retired, basically. So Gil has pretty good knowledge of George as he was.
So it's 1990. I think I'm around 14 years old by this point. And what I remember about this was that George Foreman, before the grills, was the Meineke guy. Yes, George Foreman, shaved head, smiling brightly, beating on people left and right, but doing it with a pleasant demeanor, is now America's grandpa. Oh, he sold everything, this man. And he sold it with this wonderful smile. He was like boxing Bill Cosby of that era.
Without the rape.
Without the rape. We didn't know about that. Shut up, Pat. He was America's granddad. People loved, the boxing world kind of wrote him off, but again, he kind of showed people, like, hey, I still got it, and you couldn't deny him up to this point. But, you know, the non-boxing media loved George Foreman. He was selling everything at this point, and people just, he was an icon. People adored him. It didn't matter if he even won fights after this, I think. People just loved George Foreman in this era.
He's you know, almost, I don't want to call George a parody because that's not fair, but he's essentially becoming this pitch man for these brands and, you know, using his image as a fighter and obviously, you know, kind of poking fun as he is now, where in the 70s he's this ripped monster with this afro.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Oh, and great physique and muscles. And now he's this kind of grandfatherly, bald, you know, hefty, not out of shape, but he's got a big belly as opposed to who he was. He still has big muscles, but they're a little bit covered by some rolls. And he's just using this image to become the ultimate pitchman for all these brands and a very public fixture and making light of who he used to be, and does a complete 180 in the personality department in terms of who he was. And public sentiment is on his side, partially because of that, partially because you have the crowd who remember him from his heyday and say, oh, this is a guy from my day who's going to come and shake things up and show you what the real fighters were like. And there's a little bit of that wave being ridden too, a little bit of nostalgia for that era of heavyweights. And the fact that George is able to win all these fights up until the build-up is part of the charm and the overall, I don't want to call it a media campaign because that's not fair, but it kind of is a media campaign to get George back in the spotlight.
Well, you know, we love an underdog story, and while his size and, you know, and certainly hit the early part of his career would say, what kind of underdog do you think he is? He's a former world champion. He's getting into middle age at this point. That's what makes him an underdog. 10 years of no boxing and coming back at this for an athlete,
he comes back at age 37. 37 is an age when most guys, especially in the fight game, they're either winding down their career and trying to exit gracefully.
Okay. Ryan Garcia, by contrast, who just fought on January 2nd on DAZN, wants to retire at 26, by contrast. Okay?
Canelo Alvarez, right now, isn't even 30.
Right. And, you know, and he's like looking to get in his last couple of billion-dollar fights, you know, before riding off into the sunset. So George is making that big march to Tyson. Now, Tyson's going to have his own set of problems, and we're never going to get to Tyson versus George Foreman, unfortunately. It's one of those great what-if fights that never happens. But that is the game plan, is George is eyeing Mike, and, you know, and the world is wanting Mike to hang on to the title long enough for this to happen. And as we all know in that chapter, things don't work quite well for Mike after a bit. And you can check out that podcast to hear the gory details of why things didn't work out quite the way they should have for Mike. But in the meantime, on the march, George fights Mike Jameson, TKOs him in four rounds on April 17th, 1990, at Caesars Tahoe in Nevada. He then takes on, in the same year, a couple of months later, June 16th, 1990, Adelson Rodriguez, who he KOs in two rounds.
On a doubleheader with Mike Tyson.
Yep. Should have led to a fight with Mike. It did not, unfortunately. Mike, of course, will lose the title to Buster Douglas, who will then lose the title to Evander Holyfield. And so the crosshairs move from Mike to Evander Holyfield. Mm. On the march to Holyfield, George Foreman KOs Ken LaCosta in three rounds on July 31st, 1990, in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. He then goes off to merry old England a few months later, September 25th, 1990, at the London Arena. He KOs poor Terry Anderson in the first round. Nice to know you, Terry. Which then takes us to finally the battle for the ages, they called it.
They called it the Battle of the Ages.
Okay. It's the Battle of the Ages. That's right. With $1.4 million pay-per-view buys, George Foreman went the distance with then-champ, the WBA, WBC, and IBF title holder, Evander Holyfield, on April 19th, 1991, at the Convention Hall in Atlantic City, New Jersey. So, Pat, let's talk about Evander Holyfield, George Foreman. Go ahead.
You know, this fight wasn't taken seriously for some people. And a lot of people looked at this as, okay, well, this is the fight that George wanted. Whatever happens, this is the end for George. And what George does in this fight is legitimizes every bit of his comeback effort, even though he loses. And it's, you know, a really incredible fight. And it does a lot to not only build George up, but enhance Evander Holyfield's legacy as this action warrior who was the fighter to watch in the early to mid-90s in the heavyweight division more than anybody else. You know, it's got its moments, its swings. But because he was able to stay in there with this guy who's almost, you know, I forget what the – I think the age difference at the time is 17 years. George is able to not only hang in there and just last the distance, but he has several moments in this fight where he more than holds his own. And it's that seventh round, which got voted the round of the year by Ring Magazine, that George comes out and rattles Evander with a big right hand. And, you know, he gets rattled. And Holyfield comes back with this, like, 15-16 punch combination on this immobile George. And George just takes it, and he's momentarily stunned, and he takes it. And what does he do? He comes back at the end of the round and hits Holyfield again. And then later in the fight in the 11th round, when you're thinking George is out of gas, he hits Evander so hard with a right hand that at the end of the round, Evander goes back to his corner. He asks his trainer, George Benton, are my teeth still in? Because he literally felt his teeth shift when George hit him.
After the Evander Holyfield loss, he shakes it off. He takes a few months off, and then he prepares for a comeback fight, a get-well fight against Jimmy Ellis, who he TKOs in the third round on December 7th, 1991.
Jimmy Ellis is not the Jimmy Ellis we spoke of prior, who was the WBA heavyweight champion for a period of time. This is a guy who was a walk-on Oakland Raider in the 1987 strike season, who decided to become a professional boxer. And this fight was so one-sided that HBO basically told George, under no circumstances will we ever air a fight with you against this type of opponent again.
Which brought him to Alex Stewart at the Thomas and Mack Center in Nevada. Now, this one goes to a majority decision. And all told, George Foreman should have beat him, should have finished him. But Alex Stewart gave him a fight that nobody expected on April 11th, 1992. And as I said, this goes to a 10-round majority decision where, according to the notes, I'm just going to read this. While George walked away with a narrow decision win, many, including his colleagues at HBO, where he had found yet another career as a color analyst, called for his retirement. What went wrong, even in victory, with Foreman versus Stewart?
This fight is the fight. Yeah, this fight is the fight where pretty much everybody was like, okay, we saw him fight for the title and, you know, went in a certain way, but let's never see, you know, that's where it should have ended. And then he takes a fight with Alex Stewart, who Alex Stewart was a known commodity among heavyweights. He was a good puncher. He just got a rep as a guy who froze in the big moments because he walked in against Tyson and got massacred in a round because he got knocked down three times in one round, which is the automatic not three knockdown rule stoppage. He fought Evander Holyfield and gave Evander Holyfield one of the best fights anybody had to that point in time, and loses when he gets stopped. There was a big nasty cut involved. It's a great fight. And against George, he gets knocked down twice in the second round in a fight where the three knockdown rule is in effect. And George, it's one of those things where he said that he didn't want to hurt the guy, and to a certain extent, he's one of the few guys you can say you actually believe that when he says that. But I think it's also one of those things where, because we talked about his stamina issues in his first career, George in his second career fights at a much more measured pace and sustainable, and not as frantic and manic, where he's able to conserve that energy in case he has to go the distance. And as a result of letting Stewart stay in the fight, Stewart gets his confidence and winds up doing some of his best work. And what we see here in this fight is what we see to a lot of 40-year-old guys who are getting hit by 200-something pound men repeatedly over 100 times. They're very prone to swelling and cutting and getting mangled. And George in this fight developed some of the worst... Actually, no, it was the worst George ever was disfigured in his career during the course of a fight. where his eyes were swollen shut, his lips were blown up. It was a very, very disturbing fight if you were into the George Foreman comeback, because you didn't want to see this happen to him. And it was one of those times where, even though he won the fight, and on my card he did win the fight based on the two knockdowns in the second round, so I think the decision was fair. But it was one of those times where it was like, I don't want to see – does he really need to keep doing this if he's going to take this much punishment? I don't want to see this go on anymore. And his colleagues at HBO who he was working with literally calling for George, I think this should be the end of it.
But it would not be the end of it. He will shake it off and come back on January 16th, 1993 at the Convention Center in Reno, Nevada against Pierre Kotzer, who he'll TKO in 8 rounds. Now, after that, we need to talk about this, because he's vied for the title and he's lost. But he's still looking to become a world champion. And apparently any world champion will do. At the time that this is going on, the WBO, the World Boxing Organization, is starting up, and they are looking for someone to legitimize them. And so they turn, and Pat, give a little detail on this, they turn to George Foreman and Rocky V star Tommy Morrison, who played Tommy the Machine Gun. So we get George Foreman versus Tommy Morrison on June 7th, 1993 at the Thomas and Mack Center for the vacant WBO heavyweight title. How did we get here?
How did we get here? On the same card that George fought Pierre Kotzer, Tommy fought Carl the Truth Williams. And what this was each guy was not in line to fight for the heavyweight championship of the world. You know, neither guy was seen in that elite company of Bo Holyfield, Lewis Ruddock. And so with the option of none of that available to either of them, the decision was made, what's the best payday possible for us? Well, it's to fight each other. So they set the doubleheader up to get people interested. And sure enough, they would have this fight. And just as icing on top, the then not well-regarded WBO decided to sanction this fight for what they deemed a world championship, which, you know, it wasn't at the time. So what we've got is, you know, young Tommy Morrison, who at one point in time looked like the heir apparent but suffered that horrendous loss to Ray Mercer and hasn't really looked great since then. And you've got George, who's coming off of this failed challenge to Holyfield, where he looked good, but then had this fight against Stewart where people questioned if he should still be doing it anymore. It was one of those weird, almost kind of Bellator-esque freak show fights in a certain level, but with each guy still being ranked in the top 10.
Well, George Foreman, searching for gold, it would elude him again as Tommy Morrison won a unanimous decision. And he did that by not playing George Foreman's game. If you'll remember, Tommy Morrison was a hulk of a man. Just big, broad-shouldered, very wide fellow. He had, you know, he himself had some pretty intense punching power. And Tommy Morrison was pretty light on his feet in this match. Foreman had to chase him around the ring a bunch, and Morrison did not sit down on his punches, choosing rather to throw combinations in quick fashion and move around and not let the other, you know, the heavy-handed George Foreman clock him one good. And Tommy Morrison did not have the best luck in boxing. You know, he definitely won some, but he also lost some, and we will at some point in the far future, I'm sure, dedicate a whole episode to the ups and downs of Tommy Morrison. But here, he was able to get the best of George Foreman by staying the hell away from George Foreman and hitting him with quick combinations. You want to add anything to that, Pat?
So in most of George's fights, even when he loses at the older stage, he's gracious about it. Against Tommy, he really wasn't very kind, and basically said the guy ran away from me and wasn't interested in fighting. And it's kind of true, because Tommy's known as a plant your feet, throw your power shots guy, and he didn't really do that in this fight. He absolutely really made an effort to stick and move and try to throw combinations, and it's really, really interesting to see this fight. It's not a particularly exciting fight to watch, but you see Tommy take a lot of steam off his punches, if you will, to score quicker. And there's times where George backs him up and gets him in a little bit of trouble, but Tommy's able to weather the storm. And you have to score the fight for Morrison, but it wasn't his most crowd-pleasing effort, because there are literally times in the fight where, in order to evade an exchange, he turns his back and runs.
So, still looking for gold in all the wrong places, a funny thing happened on the way to the next heavyweight fight. Evander Holyfield loses the WBA, IBF, and lineal heavyweight titles to Michael Moore. And so finally, at last, George Foreman is back in the title hunt as he fights Michael Moore for the WBA, IBF, and lineal heavyweight titles on November 5th, 1994 at the MGM Grand in Nevada. And this is a fun one, because on everyone's scorecard, Michael Moore was up, and had this thing gone the distance, more than likely, Michael Moore would have won a unanimous decision by a landslide against George Foreman. But as I said, a funny thing happened, and late in the fight, Moore was having some difficulties with his footwork. He was slowing down with his punches, and Foreman hit him with, it was either a cross or a straight right, directly in the jaw. And if you look closely, you can see Michael Moore's soul fly out of his body. I mean, he fell straight back, and I had to watch it 2 and 3 times, because I wasn't quite sure if the ref was like, "You're done, I see no sale size in your eyes," or if he just, you know, didn't beat the count, and he didn't beat the count is what it was. Like, he got a full 10, but it took me a few times to hear the ref, you know, yell 10 at him. But yeah, even if he had gotten to his feet, Michael Moore was done as soon as he hit that canvas. One punch to the jaw late in the 10th round was all it took for George Foreman to finally claim heavyweight gold in this latter half of his career. Pat, what went wrong? What went wrong for Michael Moore and went right for George Foreman beyond what I've said?
I mean, you know, this was a fight that shouldn't have been made in the first place, because you're talking about Moore, who had just become the real heavyweight champion of the world by beating Evander Holyfield, and his first challenger is a guy who had lost his last fight to Tommy Morrison and really hadn't done anything to earn the spot. But you had a Riddick Bowe, who was disinterested in fighting at the time, a Lennox Lewis, who was trying to do career rehab after his loss to Oliver McCall, and Moore, who had been a good prize fighter but had never gotten a huge payday, and now held the greatest title in the world and entitles him to a payday. Who can we get? George Foreman was the biggest payday available to him, so why not take the fight? Especially since you're pretty sure you're going to win that fight, because, you know, George is older, George is slower, I'm a southpaw, I can move, I can hit him with combinations and get out of harm's way and not play his game. But if you watch the HBO documentary, The Tale of Foreman Moore, George acquiesces to all of that and says, yeah, absolutely, that's all true. He goes, but in the fight, I'm going to set him up. And if you look, George in this fight makes more of a commitment to throwing his left hook early and often than I maybe ever have seen him do in his beginning or ending career. And it's really, it really shows you the thought process versus the maturity versus the athleticism, and how that benefited George's career. Because George whips that double left hook early and often, and what that forces Moore to do is step to his own left into the path of George's right hand. And George is a right-hand heavy puncher. So George keeps looking for that opening to land the right hand. And Teddy Atlas in the corner of Moore is yelling at him, why are you standing in front of him at various points? And the reason he does it is because Foreman shifts him over with that left hook, which Moore is blocking and not really eating flush, but it's forcing him to step where George wants him to be so he can deliver that right hand. And that's the difference between a guy like a George Foreman and a Deontay Wilder. And the thing is, George is a guy who had that weapon but figured out a delivery system for it to land when it wasn't right there for him. And that's how he did it. And when he knocks out Moore, he lands a 1-2 right before the 1-2 that puts him out. And he says he just misses hitting Moore on the point of the chin, which is true. But the punch hit him hard enough and hurt him enough that Moore was dazed immediately. And George capitalized by, again, throwing that 1-2 down the pipe, breaking Moore's mouthpiece, and, yeah, sending his soul out of his body to recapture the heavyweight championship of the world in a thing nobody thought would ever happen in one of the greatest moments in sports.
In the same era that we have the youngest heavyweight champion ever, we also now have the oldest heavyweight champion ever. What a time to be a boxing fan. The 90s. Holy cow. At 45 years old, Foreman made history as the oldest man to ever become the world heavyweight champion. He would also set the following records. Oldest man to win the heavyweight championship, longest time between heavyweight title reigns at 20 years and 6 days, largest age difference between a successful challenger and defending champion of 18 years. It's a hell of a middle age, George. Hell of a middle age. Good on ya. All right. Now we get to the part of the show where I'm going to be very forgiving because he is 45 years old and he is a good man and he has done a lot for kids, for the sport. I don't want to beat up on him too much. He's not Riddick Bowe. But these are the things that drive me nuts and make me balder than I already am. So he captures the lineal, the WBA, and IBF titles by defeating Michael Moore. And we know that the title was fractured when Riddick Bowe threw the WBC title in the trash because he didn't want to fight Lennox Lewis, which I railed on that in our last podcast. So he is stripped of the WBA title first. And he's stripped because he didn't want to face the mandatory challenger, who I believe... Refresh my memory, Pat. The mandatory challenger for the WBA was who again?
Tony Tucker.
He doesn't want to face Tony Tucker. And he didn't want to face Tony Tucker. Why?
George basically came out and said that Tony Tucker was a very tough fighter who was going to put him in all kinds of trouble if they fought. So he'd rather not do that. Now, to expand on that, you have to understand that in 1994, 1995, Tony Tucker wasn't seen as somebody who the general public of boxing was paying attention to. Even though he was ranked in a sanctioning body top 10, Tony Tucker was not seen as a top 10 heavyweight, be that fair or not. We talked a little bit about Tony back on our Mike Tyson podcast in that he probably gave prime Mike Tyson the toughest fight he had to that point. And Tucker since then had pretty much flown under the radar without major promotional support and things of that nature and not an outgoing personality. But Tucker was a good fighter. And there are certain factors that matter to everybody, and one of them, especially George at this point in time, where he accomplished the goal he had set in mind. George only had one other goal in mind at this point, which was to fight Mike Tyson, which wasn't on the table. So does George want to go in there and fight Tony Tucker for the same kind of payday he would get for fighting a cab driver? and risk his health a little bit because Tucker's a good fighter who could pose a challenge to him? Or does George want to take on a perceived easier challenger for more money? Well, if you're George, it makes a lot of sense to do the latter.
I'm going to forgive him because he's a 45-year-old man, but this irritates me to no end when this happens, because it happens now
and
in boxing. You know, you fight the mandatory challengers, you fight the guy in front of you. If you want to be the best, you fight the best, or at least whoever they can find.
Now, again, to be fair, though, George holds two sanctioning body titles at this point in time. Thus, he is faced with two mandatory challengers. And when he came to that fork in the road, he took the road less traveled.
Yes, he will be stripped of the WBA title for not fighting Tony Tucker, which leaves him the lineal title and the IBF title. And just because we can't have enough belts in boxing, they'll throw in the WBU title. Hey, Pat, you want to do 10 words on the WBU sanctioning body?
I don't have 10 words to describe it. Less said, the better.
I came down from 50 for this. No? All right. He'll go on to fight Axel Schultz, who's the mandatory for the IBF title. And like I said, they threw in this other belt just for shits and giggles on April 22nd, 1995, once again at the MGM Grand. And I'll tell you what. Axel Schultz, whatever he was up to this point and whatever he will be after this fight, gave George Foreman a run for his money. This is yet another majority decision for the champ, George Foreman. But what a tough uphill road getting there. Pat, 12 rounds, majority decision. And I think you and I talked earlier, and I said I could have gone withdraw on this one very easily. What happened here?
I scored this fight 7-5 for George Foreman, 115-113. I have no issue with scoring this fight the opposite way for Axel Schultz, or a draw, because there are a lot of close rounds in there that depend on one of two things. It depends on whether you preferred Schultz's activity level or whether you thought Foreman's power punching was more sufficient than Schultz's punching. George had a very difficult time with Axel Schultz, mainly for one reason. Schultz, even though he was not a strong puncher, I think in this fight his record is 20-1, and I believe of his 20 victories, only 10 were by knockout, which for heavyweight is not outstanding in any way. But Schultz was a very physically strong guy, so he probably did a fair amount of weight training, probably bench pressing, shoulder pressing, etc., because one of George's great strengths with his opponents, even in his older career, is his ability to push them backward, lean on them and make them carry his weight and force the action to force them to move backward or just off center so he could control the movement. He was not able to do this with Axel Schultz. Axel Schultz was able to stand right in there and push against George just as well as George could push against him. And doing that took away a lot of George's offensive capabilities. On top of that, George has always maintained that as an older fighter with his heavier weight, his balance was harder to keep, hence why he didn't throw as many combinations, more than 2 to 3 punches at most. Whereas Schultz then was able to take advantage of that, and he could get off center and throw punches at George from an angle where George couldn't punch back at him immediately, even if George was covering up, which he did a lot in this fight with his arms and a cross-arm defense, and odd intercepting arm punches. But the big difference became whether you preferred Schultz just landing as many punches as possible, even if they weren't very strong, or George, who, when he did land, did damage and hurt Schultz and pushed him back. Ultimately, to me, and I've always said this when I score rounds, the deciding factor in a very close round for me is who would I have rather been in that round? In more rounds of that fight, I would have rather been George. But it was a close fight that could have gone either way and kind of showed, George is a great story and all this is happening, but he's also 45, now 46 in this fight, years old. And maybe we shouldn't expect from him what we would expect from a 30-year-old heavyweight champion of the world.
So due to the nature of the victory, such as it was in this fight, the IBF ordered a rematch between Axel Schultz and George Foreman in Germany, the judges were said to be Axel Schulz's mother, father, and brother. George Foreman was going to be blindfolded with one hand behind his back. And George said no to all of that. No, I'm just kidding. But they did want the fight to be in Germany, on Axel's home turf. And George said pass. So he was stripped of yet another belt. This one I get. This one I understand. I think he thought he was walking into a situation where if it went to another decision, you know, this being the home turf of Axel Schulz, he was probably not going to, you know, nothing less than a knockout was going to guarantee him a win. And I just didn't think making the trip was worth it.
And not even just being Schulz's hometown, but Germany at this point in time, and for several years after the fact, is very well known as a place where visiting fighters are not going to get a fair decision their way. And it lasts this way till about the mid-2000s, where the only fair decisions in Germany involved the Klitschko brothers, who kind of adopted Germany as their homeland. But most of the time, the guys they fought didn't go to a decision. They usually got stopped. But you have guys like Darius Mikulczewski, who was a Polish-based German at that point, or a German-based Pole, I should say, who was fighting there often, and there was a lot of drama surrounding him versus Roy Jones to decide who the best light heavyweight was, and Mikulczewski wouldn't fight Jones outside of Germany, and Jones refused to fight Mikulczewski in Germany for fear of not getting a fair shake. So, you know, it was a lot of things that went on at that time with Germany. On top of that, the IBF, shortly after this, would be prosecuted under federal racketeering charges for selling rankings and doing things of the kind, which pretty much every sanctioning body does. It's just the IBF was based in the United States, thus they were a lot easier to prosecute. But as much as we don't justify George turning down a fight with Tony Tucker on the basis that Tucker was a really tough opponent, this one, at least, you can understand George's reluctance to take because he did not want to fight Germany. He did not want to face a potentially, you know, bogus decision, a commission that was probably against him, etc. I don't, you know, from the years 1995 to 2005, you can justify anybody not wanting to fight in Germany to me as long as they weren't actually German or based there.
Did he even push? I mean, did he push back and counter offer? I'll fight Axel, but, you know, New York, Chicago, Tucson,
I don't think so.
Anywhere?
But it's because the IBF was very intent on putting Axel Schulz in that position, so much so that Axel Schulz would then fight for the vacant IBF heavyweight championship against Francois Botha in Germany. Got beaten up pretty good to the point where he actually did lose the decision to Botha, but then Botha would test positive for steroids and get stripped. And then he gets another fight for the title against Michael Moorer, who edges out a very close decision over him in a fight where Schulz actually performed well down the stretch. But at that point, you've lost three title fights. You ain't getting another one, pal. And Schulz has really never heard from again on a major scale.
Speaking of never heard from again, the IBA throws a belt at George Foreman as he defends the only belt he's got left, the only other belt he's got left, the WBU, and of course the lineal heavyweight title. He does this on November 3rd, 1996, against Crawford Grimsley in NK Hall in Japan. He wins a unanimous decision there. He moves on a couple of months later, April 26th, 1997, to win a split decision against Lou Sivrise. And at this point, the sun is setting on George Foreman's career. He retains the WBU and lineal heavyweight titles. And this brings him to the last hurrah. Now, if he wins this next fight, he's going to fight for the WBC heavyweight title. This is the last shot at gold. But in order to do that, he has to get through Shannon Briggs. We'll talk a little bit more because he's going to show up in the Lennox Lewis show and the Klitschko Brothers show that we'll be doing over the course of the next few months. Shannon Briggs currently making noise to want to get in on that exhibition Tyson money. 50 words or less. Shannon Briggs, go.
I only need three. Let's go, champ.
Well, Shannon Briggs would take on George Foreman on November 22nd, 1997, at the Etis Arena in Atlantic City. And this was a title eliminator for the WBC Heavyweight Championship of the World. And George Foreman would end his career on that night, getting a majority decision, losing a majority decision to Shannon Briggs, at which point he says, "Thanks, it's been a career. I'm moving on to sell grills and to show up randomly in a Klitschko opening walkout on HBO, and I'm gonna live my life. I'm gonna be 50 years old, and I'm gonna be a happy grandpa." How does that sound? George Foreman, Shannon Briggs, your thoughts, sir?
Terrible decision. You know, this was one where George really seemed to have a fire sparked in him. And maybe it was because of the stakes involved, where had he won, he was going to be able to fight Lennox Lewis, which would have been interesting. But, you know, George really put his best foot forward in this fight. And Shannon, at the time, had the reputation of being an underachiever, where in his big showcase prior to this, he had lost by a knockout to Donnell Nicholson, where he performed so poorly that his trainer at the time, Teddy Atlas, actually left Shannon and was like, "I don't think I can do anything with you," because of Briggs citing asthma as the reason he had a problem. And in this fight, he was out-punched by George and out-hustled by him to the point where everybody, including George's HBO comrades who really didn't want him to keep fighting, all scored this fight pretty wide for George. And yet we got to the decision and we saw some way out there scorecards the opposite way for Shannon. And even Steve Weisfeld's score of a draw was not one that most people thought was justifiable. Now, stop me if you've heard this before, but there may have been a conspiracy.
Oh, yes, Jesse.
Where, because of the stakes, because George could have wound up fighting Lennox Lewis, who at the time was viewed by many as the best heavyweight in the world, and it may have just been a case of people not wanting to see George get hurt by fighting Lennox Lewis, who at this point in time, with how they matched up, probably would have hurt George, and hurt him pretty good. They may not have wanted that fight to happen, so unless George knocked Shannon out, the plan may have been all along, hey, let's save this guy's life and not see a tragedy in the ring with this beloved figure getting hurt and pummeled, like we've seen so many times before and will see so many times after the fact, unfortunately, where they scored the fight before they even saw it.
A brief coda on the career of George Foreman. He did, in fact, attempt a comeback. Late 1998, there was a scheduled fight for January 1999 with fellow aged former heavyweight Larry Holmes at the Houston Astrodome. However, as it often does, financial backing fell out and the fight was scrapped. Foreman was said to be training for yet another comeback in 2004, but the fight ultimately never materialized. So Foreman would also end his broadcasting career at HBO in 2004, citing a desire to pursue other opportunities. George Foreman, rightly so, entered the International Boxing Hall of Fame in 2003. Pat, I'm going to give you the last word here. But before I do, let me say that one of the great things about doing this podcast is, you know, it has made me a fan of fighters who I would not have known I should be a fan of. And George Foreman is right there in that top five, if not the very, very top. He was phenomenal in his heyday and an inspiration in the second half of his career. He is what many fighters should aspire to be. You know, there's a lot of heart and soul in the career of George Foreman. There was a lot of technique and power in the career of George Foreman, and I think he is one of the all-time greats. But what say you as we end this podcast?
You know, like you said at the beginning, it's a tale of two careers, and couldn't be more different in each end, other than the fact that both ends captured the heavyweight championship of the world and were highly successful. It's just his career is incomparable. There's never been anybody who did anything like him prior to it. There's never been anybody who did anything like it since. And I'd be very, very hard-pressed to think we're ever going to see anything like it again. And just from being a good man in his later stages and becoming this beloved public figure, it makes you look back at his earlier career a little more fondly than you would have had it not been for that resurrection and all the work he did in the 90s and the late 80s. And George's career is one of a kind. George is one of a kind. And I think boxing is better off as a whole for having had him when it did in both instances, because he created a lot of excitement and some of the greatest fights in the greatest era of heavyweight boxing. And in an era, and then maybe the second greatest era of heavyweight boxing, he had the greatest story ever told in the second one. So there's not a lot you can say about George without being very fond of what you're talking about and looking at it and just smiling as you talk about it, because it seems so unbelievable and so incomparable and so improbable, but it happened. In the words of Jim Lampley, it happened. And I will always look back very fondly at it and smile every time I see that clip and think of George just dropping to his knees and thanking God when he broke sports and became the heavyweight champion of the world at 45 years old after being told it'll never happen for him. You can't do it.
Well said, sir. Well said. We will be back in the month of February. We have a date picked out, but as Pat often reminds me, schedules are for... Well,
yep.
Don't schedule things too far in advance, sir. I cannot be counted on. Life is a mystery. So, we will do the next chapter, chapter 15, on Lennox Lewis, and we will bring that to you about a month from now, the latter half of February, somewhere in the 25th-ish, but don't count on that date. It might move around a bit. But yes, next up is Lennox Lewis. Then the Klitschko era. We will look at both Klitschko brothers on the same podcast. And then we have an epilogue, because we started this podcast by looking at the modern age of heavyweight boxers and comparing them to their forefathers of yore. And so we need to round back to that now and talk about what we've learned over the course of the past year doing this podcast. So that's what's up next. Our next three shows: Lennox Lewis in February, the Klitschko brothers in March, and then we will conclude this series in April. But don't worry, if you've enjoyed this podcast and you're like, no, this can't end, why is it ending? It's not. We have more to come in 2021 with more history of boxing, but we will dabble in other parts and other weight classes and other bits of history. So, you know, start thinking about the Fab Four, maybe, huh? Marvin Hagler, Sugar Ray Leonard, what do you think? So that's what's coming up in the near future. In the meantime, in between time, this past week, we looked at The Boys, Volume 2, Get Some on Source Material Live. We then reviewed The Boys, Season 2. That's brought to you by Amazon Prime. We reviewed AEW New Year's Smash both nights, and the second...
Gross.
The second chapter of the Transformers War for Cybertron, Earthrise, on TV Party. And this week, coming up, we'll be looking at The Mandalorian Season 2. So we'll be looking at Bounty Hunters, the first 5 issues by Ethan Sachs. We'll review Impact Hard to Kill featuring Kenny Omega from AEW. Uh-huh. We will be doing an On Trial for the Karate Kid 2010 featuring Bruce Lee and Jaden Smith. And finally, Pat's favorite show, we will be reviewing Season 3 of Cobra Kai this week.
Yeah.
One show out of like 900 that Pat will want to listen to.
It's true.
It's all true. All right, Pat, I know you record the boxing podcast with me. Do you have anything else that you're working on?
No.
Terrific. All right, folks. We thank you for joining us tonight on the History of Boxing podcast, brought to you by the Rattledge and Broadcasting Network. For Pat Mullen, I'm Mark Rattledge. Be well, be safe, and behave.